I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
Support comes from Grady Health Foundation, presenting Move for Grady Saturday, April 27th, featuring a family-friendly bike ride through Atlanta's in-town neighborhoods. There's a ride, run, or walk distance for everyone, benefiting Grady Health System. More at moveforgrady.com.
Somewhere around here is where it happened. Somewhere in this beautiful expanse of Georgia woods, something terrible, tragic, and long forgotten, except by those who lived it. As I walk through the dry leaves of this forest, the sun flickers through the tall pines like a strobe. We're in Alston, in South Georgia. This land used to be a farm owned by a black family, the Nixon family. Three generations of them lived in a wood farmhouse with a tin roof, somewhere on this property, 70 years ago. It was a pretty good-sized farm, 59 acres. They raised crops. They traveled by horse and wagon, and they relied on a mule named Della. And this is where two white men drove up to Isaiah Nixon's farmhouse in the late afternoon of Election Day in Georgia, September 1948. They had guns in their hands. They had menace in their voices, and they insisted on seeing the farmer. So Isaiah Nixon emerged from the house. His mother, his wife, his children watched as he stepped down off the porch and walked toward the men. Understand now, he knew them. He'd grown up with them. And they had their guns out? Their intent became clear when they asked Isaiah Nixon two questions. Had he voted? And who for? Now, as I walk this land, I can't help but wonder where exactly Isaiah Nixon was standing when he answered those two questions, when he refused to take a ride with them, and when one of the white men shot him, one, two, three times in front of his family. I'm going to tell you that story and more about what happened on this election day in 1948, the history that led up to it and the history that followed it. But now, in these silent woods, I hear the voices of people who have shared their memories with me about that time, that day, this place.
She begged him not to go because she knew the possibility that he was going to be killed.
He told him that if he knew what was best, that he wouldn't vote.
I felt like they probably got away with murder.
So we know who did it. We know what happened. We know when and how. We know it was somewhere around here. But there's one remaining question. Why? Why did these men... Why did so many men like them get away with murder in the South? Who were we? Who were we as a people that we allowed this to happen? That's our search. And this is our story. Because when we understand who we were, we can better understand who we are. This is Buried Truths. I'm Hank Klibanoff. It was the mid-1940s. A loaf of bread would cost about 10 cents. A mortgage was about $50 a month. And most Americans made about $2,500 a year. But in the South, the cost of living wasn't measured just by what you could afford. This is the American South, post-World War II. Black soldiers who helped liberate Europe from Nazis have returned to find they still have few of the rights and opportunities of whites. Daily behavior is still governed by strictly enforced rules of racial etiquette. Bow the head. Step off the sidewalk when whites approach. Don't ever look a white woman in the eye. Stay out of white schools except to push a mop. Don't enter white restaurants except through the back door. Stay out of white homes unless you're the help. Don't vote with us. Don't pray with us. Don't drive a nicer car than us. Just don't. In Alston, Georgia, and to the farmhouse of 28-year-old Isaiah Nixon. What we know about him comes mainly from his family, especially his daughter, Dorothy.
We were way out in the woods, so when we went into town, it was on a wagon and going to pick up food and especially flour and meal, that kind of stuff. They had almost everything else, but if you close your eyes, you would have passed through Alston.
Alston, Georgia, population 150. Dorothy's dad, her mom Sally, her five brothers and sisters lived on their farm, where they grew tobacco and cotton and other crops. Dorothy's grandmother also lived with them.
So they had all kinds of products. They even had a lot of fruit trees, grapevines, apple tree, peach tree. It was just wonderful. The farm was on the left. The timber was on the right. So you could just walk across the street almost away from the house, maybe 10 or 12 feet now, and you can start with the timber.
The timber, the pine trees. Dorothy remembers Isaiah Nixon, buckets and a small chipping tool in hand, disappearing among the pines. The trees were fertile sources of turpentine. To harvest it, Isaiah Nixon would nail a bucket into the trunk of a tree, then start scraping and chipping the bark until the sap slowly filled the bucket. All those hours on the farm and among the trees, Isaiah Nixon had plenty of time to think about the future of his kids. He wanted them to have more fairness, more opportunity, more respect. But ensuring a better life was going to be tough. Because Isaiah Nixon was a black man with aspirations and a white world, and the white supremacist world of this man, Gene Talmadge.
And that is the priorities that veterans are supposed to have in purchasing.
Gene Talmadge wanted to be a lawyer, but he never quite made it, so he turned his attention to politics. He ran twice for the state legislature and lost both times. So, clearly unpopular locally, what did he do? He ran statewide and became agriculture commissioner. Then he set his political goals even higher. With unbridled ambition, his brash oratorical style started getting him noticed across the South and eventually on the national stage.
You're the ones that I'm counting on to match that solid block of Negro votes that I know's going to vote against me.
Talmadge presented himself as a populist, a fighter for the little guy. Of course, as long as the little guy was white. Gene Talmadge was a disruptive force with an angry message.
Listen, you read the bus decision where the Supreme Court held that Negroes could sit beside of any people on your buses. Did you read it?
Wherever Gene Talmadge campaigned was like the circus come to town, and he was the ringmaster. Wearing his trademark red suspenders, he was trailed by believers who were planted in the crowd, sometimes in the trees, to yell out set-up questions that Talmadge would answer to roaring applause, hoots, and hollers. He unfurled fiery speeches against government, federal and state, even as he ran for higher and higher offices in Georgia's government. By the early 1940s, he'd been elected governor three times, and in 1946, he was running again for a fourth term.
Now let's elect Gene Talmadge. He is the people's friend.
Gene Talmadge, like many politicians of his time, owned a newspaper, The Statesman, and he used his newspaper to drive wedges between people. To rally rural voters, he railed against them lying Atlanta newspapers. To appeal to poor farmers, Talmadge targeted banks and utilities. To create fear among whites, he warned blacks were out to get their jobs. In fact, he warned, blacks were out to get just about everything the white man had. No surprise, then, that when Gene Talmadge was governor, the Ku Klux Klan had open access to him and his inner offices. Here is how Gene Talmadge explains his attitude on race in America in his newspaper. He did so in all capital letters. This is a white man's country, and we must keep it so.
So let's elect Gene Talmadge and bring back once again that wise administration of the red suspended man. Let's pay the teacher's salary.
But politics was far from the young mind of Dorothy Nixon back in Allston, Georgia.
The whole life was wonderful to me, playing in the dirt and all the little ones running around. We had wood stoves, outhouse, and you know, we had pails on the inside at night.
She stayed close to her grandmother, Daisy, who owned the farm. Dorothy was in wonder of that life.
I helped my grandmother in the vegetable garden next to the house. When the ground broke for sweet potatoes, I was excited and she let me pull them up and shake off the dirt. Same thing with peanuts. I thought peanuts, for instance, you just go get them. I didn't know they grew in the ground and it breaks and then you pull it up and you shake it. And so that was the fun part.
The fun part. But she still made time for some childhood mischief.
We used to go under the house and play. And my older sister, we tried to get the grapes and make wine, but we got caught. And we were little, so we didn't know what we were doing.
How did it taste? Why?
I can't remember.
And of course, Dorothy still remembers her father, Isaiah Nixon.
My father was an only child, my grandmother's only child. Well, he used to bring us these really large peppermint. And if you got yours, I mean, that was really something. I don't remember him raising his voice or nothing. He was just easygoing. Sort of, you know, called up introspective. I mean, he wasn't a big man, but he acted like a giant to me.
As Dorothy lived her peaceful childhood life on the farm in Allston, over to the west in Columbus, Georgia, was a black man who, like Isaiah Nixon, was looking for a way to move his life forward. See, in the early 1940s, black residents in Georgia weren't allowed to vote when it really counted. And this man wanted to change that. His name was Primus King. He recounted his story late in life in this recording. But it's hard to hear, so we've asked an actor to voice his words. Primus King was a barber and a pastor, and he, along with his friends, had come up with a plan.
This case came up testing the Democratic Party primaries and Negroes voting. Several talked about it, but nobody was willing to put a bell around the cat's neck. I told them, I will.
The bell around the cat's neck, or who would be the first black voter to challenge the system. Let's take a minute to talk about that system. In the mid-1940s in southern states, white politicians used a series of devious schemes to keep blacks from the polls. You've heard about some of them, of course, the literacy tests, the poll taxes. Here's another. While blacks could vote in the general election, they could not vote in the Democratic Party primary. The Democratic Party in Georgia openly called that their all-white primary. And what they really meant was their whites-only primary.
Well, now, wait a
I went in there to vote. When I went in, the detectives grabbed me, asked, "What in the hell are you doing, nigger?" I say, "I'm going to vote, sir." Detective said, "Ain't no niggers voting here today."
So the Democratic Party insisted that it was a private club, sort of like a civic association, and it alone could decide who would participate in its activities. That is, who would be allowed to vote in its primary. The explanation to blacks went something like this. "We're going to let you vote. We're going to let you vote in the general election in November, the final, the most important election, when we all decide together." But black Georgians saw that for the trick that it was. They knew the general election was meaningless because in southern states, Democrats made up 80 to 90% of the voters. So whoever won the primary would take office in January.
So I walked away to a lawyer. It was three blocks.
To the office of a white lawyer, Oscar Smith, to make his case.
Lawyer said to me, "Primus, do you really want to sue the Democratic Party? Do you know what you're doing?" I told him, "Yes, sir, I know." When I got there, he said we could sue for $5,000. We sued, and it came out in the paper that afternoon. Primus King has sued the Democratic Party for denying him rights and privilege to vote because of race and color.
And that also made Primus King an instant target.
Later on, an old cracker called me and said, "You must want to be put in the river." I said, "Well, they put so many Negroes in the river for nothing. I'm willing to go in there for something." He hung up the phone.
So what were whites so afraid of? Well, the math. In Georgia, a third of the counties had black majorities. Political leaders feared losing control, and they were willing to whip whites into a frenzy to hold that power. Here's how Gene Talmadge explained it in his newspaper, The Statesman. "If the door is once opened and we allow the Negro to participate in our primaries, the next move will be to allow them in our schools with our white children."
So I stood there in court with tears running down my cheeks. I said, "Your Honor, I want the right and the privilege to vote for my people."
The case was tried in Macon, Georgia. A white federal judge ruled that Democrats must let Primus King vote. And then a Southern federal appeals court agreed. And then the United States Supreme Court refused to hear the appeal, giving Primus King a historic win.
Primus King had won the case. This Negro had won in the South.
And with this victory, a wave of hope spread throughout the black communities all over Georgia. But it would also set in motion a tragedy, the killing of the farmer in Allston, Isaiah Nixon. This is Buried Truths, and there's so much more to come in this episode. So stay with us. I'm Hank Klibanoff.
You love free. And at Ameris Bank, so do we. That's why we're proud to offer worry-free, hassle-free Ameris Bank free checking. Manage your money your way with convenient access to digital, mobile, and telephone banking, all with no monthly service fee or minimum balance requirements. At Ameris Bank, we're with you. For more information or to open an account, visit our local bankers in person or online at amerisbank.com/free checking. Other fees such as overdraft fees may apply. Ameris Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Support for WABE's local coverage on maternal health and mortality comes from Georgia Health Initiative, whose mission is to inspire and promote collective action that advances health equity for all Georgians. Learn more at GeorgiaHealthInitiative.org.
So at this point in our story, where do we stand? We know that blacks would now be allowed to vote for the first time in the 1946 Democratic primary. This was unwelcome news for Gene Talmadge and his supporters, but not for Isaiah Nixon. In fact, black Georgians immediately began registering to vote. In Chatham County, home to Savannah, Democrats were startled to see black registration soar overnight from 1,200 to 7,000. The Atlanta Daily World, a black newspaper, felt giddy enough to run a headline that said, "Talmadge in a dither." And it was around this time that Isaiah Nixon got a visit from his good friend Dover Carter. Dover Carter also lived in Allston, and he too was a farmer. Now, Mr. Carter had just come from Savannah, where he had attended a meeting of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP. And Dover Carter was so taken by their mission to expand black political influence that he decided to start a local chapter back in Alston. One of his early converts, Isaiah Nixon. When the U.S. Supreme Court sided with Primus King, it enraged Gene Talmadge because it meant that his political foes, the Negroes, could now line up to vote against him in what had once been an all-white primary. And what really got Talmadge upset? That stunning decision landed just 3 weeks before the 1946 primary. Gene Talmadge decided he needed a new strategy to stop blacks from voting. He met with a Klansman, the Exalted Cyclops. They discussed what they could do. Talmadge himself came up with an idea. Without speaking, he picked up a pencil, he tore off a piece of paper, and he wrote one word on it. Pistols.
Atlanta Journal for coming out about 2 months ago.
So now, with just a week to go till Election Day, Gene Talmadge gave this speech. As you'll hear, he was not giving up on the idea of an all-white primary.
Of a Democratic white primary in Georgia.
Talmadge spoke during a thunderstorm.
Now, what do my opponents say? They say that it's the law and Negroes will vote in the primary this year, next Wednesday. And they stop right there. What do I say? I say it's the law this year, and some of the Negroes will vote. The fewer the better. But I add to it this. If I'm your governor, they won't vote in our white primary the next 4 years.
And so around this time, the Talmadge forces and voting officials sympathetic to Talmadge began removing names of black registered voters. The FBI would later estimate that 50,000 blacks in Georgia had been purged or pressured into not registering, some after being peppered with random, vague questions about democracy, others after being asked to recite parts of the Constitution. The purge became so obvious that pretty soon, FBI agents were swarming Georgia, investigating not just the county voting officials, but Gene Talmadge himself. So the big question in the days before the election was which would come first, the election of Gene Talmadge or his indictment? In the final days of the campaign, the intimidation continued. On the Sunday before the 1946 primary in Fitzgerald, Georgia, black worshipers at 8 different churches arrived to find signs on the doors that read, "The first Negro to vote in the white primary will never vote again." Election Day approached, and then in July 1946, Gene Talmadge won. He'd take the Democratic Party primary, and he'd win in November, too. But Gene Talmadge would never live to take office. You might think that after this election, the racial violence would take a break, but it didn't. 5 days later, a mob of white men in Monroe, Georgia, committed what was probably the state's most heinous racial killing, the execution of 2 black couples at Moore's Ford Bridge. And in a case directly related to voting, over in Butler, Georgia, 4 white men showed up at the family home of a World War II vet, Maceo Snipes. He'd been the only black person to vote in Taylor County. The men called him outside, then shot and killed him. The same week, a young student at Morehouse College sent a letter to the editor of the Atlanta Constitution. He decried the unfair and unequal ways that black citizens were being treated. It was his debut in the national debate over race. He signed his letter, M. L. King. Back in Austin, Dover Carter was undaunted. The man who recruited Isaiah Nixon to the NAACP was on a roll. Within just a few months after starting his local chapter, he'd signed up 74 members in and around Austin. He'd seen too much to turn back now.
I remember him telling me stories of atrophy.
This is Dover Carter's son, Aaron.
Atrophy and individuals being whipped and even hung. And so I think the injustice that he saw was a thing that motivated him.
Now, Dover Carter was better off than most blacks in Austin. He owned his own farm, and he could be seen driving through town in his pickup truck. His son, Aaron, tells us he was serious, religious, and curious.
Now that's a state.
You know, back during the campaign for governor in 1946, if you listened carefully, you might have heard something.
I'm proud of y'all. I wish that I was.
Gene Talmadge was sick.
Had room for more, but they overcrowded.
Gene Talmadge was suffering from cirrhosis of the liver, internal bleeding, and other diseases.
In this county, and I've only found one county in.
Yes, Gene Talmadge was an alcoholic, and he was dying. And just before Christmas, in December 1946, weeks after his election and weeks before he'd become governor again, Gene Talmadge died.
Just wait, we'll get to it. Now, you know, that was about what I announced on.
This led to one of the more bizarre political episodes in Georgia's history. Because over the next couple of months, three different men would claim to be the rightful heir to the governor's office. More on that later. For now, here's what's important to know. The Georgia Supreme Court ruled that the Lieutenant Governor Melvin Thompson should take the office. It also ordered a special election for governor for September 1948. But the Talmadge dynasty wasn't going away quietly. One of the candidates running for governor, Gene's son, Herman.
The President of the United States.
But you really can't talk about this period in the South without remembering what was happening nationally and in Washington, D.C., as we headed into the next presidential election. Harry Truman had become president after FDR died, and now he was running in his own right. And a very large question was where Truman would take the Democratic Party and the White House. Would it be toward civil rights? Or toward the segregationist views of the Southern Democrats who controlled the Congress. Truman made his views clear in June of 1947 when he became the first president ever to address the NAACP, symbolically on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. He did it in front of more than 10,000 people.
Many of our people still suffer the indignity of insult, the harrowing fear of intimidation, and I regret to say, the threat of physical injury and mob violence.
He said the nation could no longer afford a leisurely attack on prejudice and discrimination.
We cannot wait another decade or another generation to remedy these evils. We must work as never before to cure them now.
So Truman speaks of a cure for prejudice and discrimination. Down South, this was not going to be easy. It would take eradication of a lot more than the disease of racism that had afflicted one man, Gene Talmadge. This was a political virus, and it had stricken the Deep South for decades. White supremacist politicians had found Southerners an easy mark for their evangelical demagoguery. And what was that all about? Well, it was all designed to win elections by dividing and conquering, by pitting poor whites against poor blacks.
I should like to talk to you briefly.
Now, besides Gene Talmadge, there was Mississippi's Theodore Bilbo, who publicly said the best way to stop blacks from voting on Election Day was the night before. South Carolina's Cotton Ed Smith, who had walked out of the 1936 Democratic National Convention because the opening prayer was to be given by a black pastor. Now, these men were only the latest strain of the virus. Before them were Pitchfork Ben Tillman of South Carolina, Tom Watson in Georgia, James K. Vardaman in Mississippi.
The Civil Rights Law.
So this speech by Harry Truman to the NAACP was a direct message to the white Southerners who believed in and who were still infected by this political virus. The nation, Truman said, could no longer wait for, quote, the slowest state or the most backward community. He also cautioned Southerners to not look to their state leaders.
Our national government must show the way.
The national government, the federal government. And then, to close,
it is more important today than ever before to ensure that all Americans enjoy these rights. When I say all Americans, I mean all Americans.
With this speech, Truman turned his back on Southern Democratic leaders. More than 650 miles away, in Austin, we can pretty much guess that NAACP members like Isaiah Nixon and his good friend Dover Carter heard about Truman's speech and were inspired by it. As Georgia and the nation headed into critical elections in 1948, these farmers continued to meet and encouraged blacks to register to vote. But it was still a tense time. Once again, Isaiah Nixon's daughter, Dorothy.
It's hard to visualize 1948 as opposed to 1960, 70, 80, 90. In those days, if they decided that they were going to abuse black kids or wives, black men and fathers had no choice. We had no rights.
Isaiah Nixon, Dover Carter, and the others in the movement were worried. What if the Talmadge dynasty took back control of the government in the 48 election?
The time has come for Georgia to take her rightful place, and we will have a leader when Herman wins the race.
Herman Talmadge looked just like his father. And he ran as his father's son. Herman, or as he was more widely known, Humman, assured voters the political dynasty would remain intact and little would change. In the governor's office, white supremacists, the Ku Klux Klan, they knew they'd still have a friend in the state's highest office. His appeal? Well, he sounded a lot like his dad. In fact, here's a part of a speech Herman Talmadge had given while campaigning for his father.
The other candidates for governor are opposed to a white primary. They know that the loss of the white primary will destroy our Southern traditions and principles, yet these self-seeking politicians would sell out their birthright that our grandfathers fought for a few votes. Remember this.
Herman Talmadge clearly is sounding very much like his father. And if you're a black voter in 1948, you're thinking that Herman Talmadge is going to be just as aggressive in trying to suppress the black vote as his father was. In the closing days, Herman Talmadge warned that any blacks who came into polling places with a sample ballot or written guidance on how to vote should be arrested and prosecuted. Because, according to Herman Talmadge, any blacks who came to the polls with such a guide, what he called a marked ballot, weren't intelligent enough to vote. And as the 48 election day neared, the Klan, in open support of Herman Talmadge, marched through black communities in and around Austin. The tension grew from a simmer to a boil, especially among members of the NAACP, but that wasn't going to keep them from voting. Isaiah Nixon's daughter, Dorothy, says he certainly wasn't afraid of casting a vote.
But no, he wasn't afraid, because if he was afraid, he would not have gone at all. He would have done what a lot of people did. They did not go and vote because they knew what could happen to them.
One of the newest members of the NAACP in Alston was John Harris. He, too, was a longtime friend of Isaiah Nixon and Dover Carter. Now, John Harris was a handyman and also a farmer, and he tells the story of how NAACP members were meeting at a church in Alston just days before the 1948 election when they got a visitor, a white neighbor who walked into the church uninvited. He was carrying something in his hand. He was carrying a whip. John Harris's son, James, picks up the story.
He would come down here when they were meeting. See, he would walk in the church, walk from the back to the front with his whip. See, he would walk up the aisle, and on his way out, would take his whip and pop it and go out the door. They say he never said anything.
A whip at a meeting in a church? It wouldn't work. These black farmers, John Harris, Dover Carter, and Isaiah Nixon, were undaunted. Within days, they would do something truly courageous. But they would pay a price for it. You gotta hear what happens on the next episode of Buried Truths. I'm Hank Klibanoff.
Hank Klibanoff is a former reporter, editor, and co-author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Race Beat. Today, he's a professor at Emory University. Buried Truths is produced by David Bereswain and Kate Sweeney, edited by John Haas. The executive producer is Christine Dempsey. Please subscribe to the show. And if you have a moment, leave us a review in Apple Podcasts. We'd love to hear what you think, and your review will help others find the show.
The idea for this podcast came from a class that I've been teaching at Emory University in Atlanta. That's where I direct the Georgia Civil Rights Cold Cases Project. Over the years, I've asked my students to research stories like the one you're hearing, and what they have found is fascinating, even astonishing. You'll get to hear from a couple of them, and you'll get to hear about the hidden history they've uncovered. There was one more thing that I wanted to mention that deserves some extra time. So we have a bonus episode about what happened right after Jean Talmadge died. We told you that three men would lay claim to the governor's office. Well, this tussle over the governorship made national headlines. It was known as the Three Governors Controversy, and it was just this almost comical moment in Georgia history. And it showed just what the Talmadge clan, that's clan with a C, but frankly also with a K, it showed what the Talmadge clan would do to stay in office. Look for it in a Buried Truths bonus episode coming up in a few days.
We had help on this episode of Buried Truths from the nearly 100 students who've taken the Civil Rights Cold Cases class that Hank Klibanoff teaches, and thanks to Professor Brett Gadsden, who helped create and teach the course. Special thanks to two past students who have stayed with the project, Ellie Studdard and Lucy Baker. If you have any information related to this case, you can write or send a voice memo to stories@buriedtruths.org. You can follow us on social media at Buried Truths Podcast, where you'll find photographs and documents related to the case. Thanks to Emory University and its Centers for Digital Scholarship and Faculty Excellence for their support. We had help from the National Archives and Records Administration and from the General Oral History Collection at Columbus State University. And we had additional help from the Richard B. Russell Library for Political Research and Studies at the University of Georgia, with archive recordings from their Herman Talmadge collection. And finally, thanks to the actor Rob Cleveland, who played the voice of Primus King. Buried Truths is a production of WABE Atlanta.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The world is full of mysteries. Are ghosts real? Is that yogurt expired? Hey, the unknown can be scary. But when you donate to WABE, you know where your money is going. Your gift supports the journalism that keeps you informed and the programs that pull back the curtain on complicated stories. Help us make the world less mysterious. Become a member now. Go online to wabe.org/donate, and thanks.